Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today is all about food and love. Well, food and sex, really. Specifically, the idea of aphrodisiacs, foods which it's claimed have an erotic power. In modern times, oysters or chocolate are claimed to do the job, but further back, foie gras and caviar. Through history, stranger things still. On my travels making food documentaries in some of the world's more difficult places, I've been offered all sorts. Rhino horn, and I wasn't asking for these things, by the way. Rhino horn, gorilla paw, testicles and penises of various strange species. I ate a yak's penis once. It was soft, yet chewy, since you ask, and very, very, very long. But none of these have ever had any aphrodisiacal effect. So here's the question. Do food aphrodisiacs actually work? And if so, is it about the food or the context? There's much talk of pheromones, but the evidence of their effect on human arousal is pretty slim. You can Google the Belgian study on pheromones and their effect on women's mood and sexuality. Not that much to write home about, but that doesn't stop anyone looking for them or making claims for them. We're going to dig into the history of aphrodisiacs to find out a bit more. And on the way, we'll see how the food industry has tapped into these sensual food and drinks. Well, with me are two absolutely fabulous guests. We have Ursula Janssen. She's an archaeologist, culinary historian, and author of several books, including historical novels and recipe books. Hello there, Ursula.
Hi.
Great to have you. We've also got Martha Hopkins from marketing and book publishing company Terrace Partners. In 1997, she co-wrote Intercourses, an aphrodisiac cookbook, which has sold, and just wait for it, 325,000 copies in the United States and Canada alone. Hello there, Martha.
Hello.
Riding high on that figure, I would imagine. Now, Martha, can we start off with you? I mean, let's step back from this a second and just work out, how would you define an aphrodisiac?
Well, for most people, when they think about aphrodisiacs, they're just thinking about foods that sort of get things rolling and either get you in the mood for the bedroom or help you perform better once you're there.
It's a slightly nebulous idea, though, isn't it? Because that could be that could mean lots of different things. Ursula, over the course of history, has the idea, because there's a bit of sort of date rape drug sort of side to this as well, isn't there? I mean, yep. It sounds a bit dodgy. In the course of history, has this idea of an aphrodisiac changed at all?
Yes, I would say yes, it did. Because indeed, before we have to talk about it, we should definitely define it. I mean, in general, I would say it's an ingredient, a substance or a dish that is meant to enhance lust and passion. But in the past, often also fertility was an important point. And right. What is now called, or what we would now call an aphrodisiac, if we look back at those, they were often then in the explanation why they were considered an aphrodisiac. Also, fertility was an important argument. So that has definitely changed. I mean, historically, the word aphrodisiac comes from the Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite. And because she was said to carry a number of mysterious love potions at her belt, and these were the aphrodisiacs. So yes, you also have this love potion idea pretty much from the beginning.
And can we extrapolate this? I mean, can we separate the love bit from the sex bit, Ursula? I mean, don't get me wrong. I know they're closely interlinked, but what was more important?
Well, it depends very much. I mean, I would divide aphrodisiacs into seven different categories. Some of them are more focused on the, let's say, biological part, and some are more focused on lust, on passion. And I definitely think that the sensual part plays a big, 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 big role, because we know that many of those foods that have ever been considered an aphrodisiac, and if we look back into history, also on an international level, we see that basically there's nothing that has not claimed to be an aphrodisiac at some point in history.
The potato was once claimed to be an aphrodisiac, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Anything.
Yeah. Before we go on, could you mentioned seven groups.
Yes.
Could you tell us what those seven are?
Yes, of course. I would start with shape analogy. So anything, any food that visually reminds us of either female or male reproductive organs, that could be all kind of mussels and shellfish, that could be asparagus, anything that is long, carrots, celeriac things, even lettuce actually, not because the round lettuces we know now, but because if you see lettuces, if you let them grow, they shoot up and they have this white sap coming out from the top. So, I mean, they're very...
Where's the white sap coming out of your lettuce, Ursula?
If you let
Ursula
it grow...
Ursula is joining us from Puglia in Italy, where clearly lettuces are slightly different these days.
No, if you forget to harvest it and it overgrows.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. When it goes to seed.
Yes, exactly.
Which is, yes, very appropriate. Yeah, okay, so that's the shape.
Yeah, that's the shape. Then we have high-protein foods. In history, nutrition was not as given as it is now. So anything that is strengthening, basically. And for this, basically high-protein foods, especially eggs, because there you also have the fertility aspect. So all kinds of eggs, bird eggs, fish eggs, there is sometimes it was like, for example, at the court of Louis the 15th in France, a mix of raw egg yolks and ginger was used, and they used to add alcohol. I mean, an eggnog in the end is nothing else. There is a medieval Arab treatise that describes the consumption of big, of huge quantities of eggs as the key to male potency, whereas this one only talks about male potency. That's another thing, actually, we should be discussing, because a lot of these treatises talk about, they have a pretty male point of view, let's put it like that.
Well, yes, it sounds like it. Okay, so we've got shape, we've got high protein. What's number three?
Number three, I would say, is humorism. The concept of humorism is the antique concept that was used until early modern times in medicine that divides basically anything, all kinds of foods, but also all kinds of body types into four categories, which is, it's blood, back bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And to these attributed are hot and wet, cold and wet, hot and dry, and cold and dry.
Yeah.
Which does not mean the actual temperature, but kind of foods are attributed to it. So everything like chili, garlic, everything that is spicy is hot, and pickled cucumbers are cold, for example.
Yeah, gotcha.
And this was very, very, very important as a concept in medicine and also for aphrodisiacs. Basically, everything that is hot was considered an aphrodisiac. And hence, for example, in the Middle Ages, in monasteries, hot foods were avoided and they rather got things like pickled vegetables, which were considered cold.
Yeah.
And this is why we have a lot of also antique recipes or proportions to eat lots of garlic and onions, which, of course, also has an adverse effect in terms of smell.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, but probably both have to eat it, then it's fine.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Okay, so that is humorism, yeah?
Okay, number four.
Number four is what I would say is exotic and thus expensive and rare foods. Luxury.
Now we're hitting the mother load here. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, luxury is, it's the central part in the end. It's the feeling of having a special day, evening, night, whatever. I think this is more important than many of the actual ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. And back to context again. Okay, so we've got exotic and luxury. Number five.
Yeah, number five is the idea, what you were talking before of the rhinoceros penises and stuff, is the idea of transferring powers from other creatures onto the consumer.
Yeah.
There is no evidence whatsoever that it works. It has been done for a long time and it is... not advisable.
Yeah,
absolutely. Simply, yeah, I think absolutely. We can pretty... I mean, another quite disgusting use was in early modern times was the mumia, the powdered human Egyptian mummies that were sold as a general tonic, but also specifically as an aphrodisiac. And it actually comes from a translation mistake, because mumia in Arabic is a kind of bitumen-like substance that is used as a general tonic in the Middle East, and was also used in ancient Greek. And this is why the mummies are called mummies, because that was also used for embalming those bodies. Yeah. But lost in translation, they thought they meant actual mummies, which is a sobering reminder of the value of correct translations.
Yeah, absolutely. I find that grinding up my dead relatives really gets it going for me. Okay, and number six, we got a couple more to get through here.
Yes, so number six is, I think, is the sensual side in general, apart from the exotic, which is a good smell, in antiquity, especially at banquets, incense was burned to create a festive environment, or also to help cover bad body odors, which in times before regular showers or baths were available to everyone, was also important. And this is why, for example, in medieval treatises, mint is regarded as an aphrodisiac, simply to cover up bad breath.
When I was a teenager, whenever I smelt, I just added more deodorant over the top. There was no point in going for a bath. Okay, so smell, taste, and the sight, I guess, and things like that. And number seven.
Yeah, and number seven, I would say there are substances that have an actual effect on the body, which exists but is rare. There are some, few kitchen spices or herbs like saffron, nutmeg, but you also shouldn't overdo them. Parsley, but you need to eat huge, enormous quantities to get there, which I'm not sure whether...
You can hallucinate on nutmeg, can't you, as well? But, I mean, you gotta eat a heck of a lot of it.
And probably the most potent legal food-related drug is alcohol.
Exactly.
Aphrodisiac, yeah. But also in moderation, again, because too much is counterproductive.
Exactly. We're talking about hydraulics here at certain levels, aren't we? And so you've got to bear that in mind. Okay, so Martha, this is an interesting idea, that the idea of what an aphrodisiac is and its power has changed through history. What about now? I mean, I've asked my friends in the past, do they see certain foods as aphrodisiac? There's no real consensus. People sort of clutch at straws of things that they've heard of before, like oysters and things with lots of zinc in and things like that. Mainly, though, I actually did a little survey once, and I asked them, what did they imbibe before they last had sex? And invariably, so sort of turning the question on its head a bit, and invariably they said alcohol, but also a takeaway meal, and a meal that was expensive, and then came up a meal that was cheap as well. I mean, this seems to be quite random. Is it context specific, do you think, or is it personal to you, or is there something that you can guarantee will help people get in the mood?
Well, I have no guarantee, but I do recommend a good imagination and just having an open mind to it. Mm-hmm. I think for today, there's a whole variety of things. Like, that list from history still applies on so many levels. You know, if you're eating asparagus or it's a phallic symbol, albeit a little more slender than some might like, or you take an artichoke, and I don't know if you've ever steamed it, and you don't even have to cut off the leaves. You just pull it apart with your fingers and you kind of dive in, and there's like sort of yellows and purples and greens, and then you're pulling off each petal and you pull it between your teeth and well, be careful with that. But, you know, it's just this very sensual experience with your mouth.
Yeah.
One thing, you mentioned high protein. And I remember one night my husband and I went out for a good meal at this Italian restaurant. We were already in the mood before we got there. And then we ordered like 40 plates of pasta and bread. And all you wanted to do, we were just like, can you wheelbarrow me home? This is not. But then if we're at home and we make just mussels, first of all, have you taken a look at a mussel recently? Because it's literally obscene. And so, and then it's high protein and it's low carbs. If you just have, you know, half a piece of bread to dredge into the broth or the stock, and then you have a glass of wine, but not two glasses of wine, definitely not three. Mm. And so you sort of not done anything but help your body perform better and feel better, and you've not bogged it down. So all of that matters. You know, with intercourses, all the recipes are home tested by couples across the country. And stunningly, they all worked. Here's why. Because I said, here's a recipe that's an aphrodisiac. Can you tell me how it worked? Well, okay, we're all going to step up to that challenge. It's fun. And as far as like takeaway, expensive, cheap, whatever, here Valentine's Day is coming up. People are going to go out and eat the crappiest food ever because everyone in the entire world is sitting in there at the 7 o'clock or the 9 o'clock slot or whatever, and it's just not good. So if you want to do it at home, it needs to be either quick and easy or make ahead. You don't want to be just like in the kitchen cooking the whole time. And that's where I think the takeaway comes into play.
Yeah.
It's just like simplified. I personally don't like to cook with anyone. If my husband comes in, I'm like, can you please leave? But a lot of people love this idea of, you know, cooking together. And it does sound romantic, unless you're in my marriage, and then it's not. But that whole idea of coming together, putting down your telephone, literally, no phone in the room, unless you're filming yourselves, I guess. But, you know, you just set it aside. If it's even there, you're going to notice it. And it's that break away from connecting with your partner.
Yeah.
And as far as you can separate love and sex, for sure, like you can totally do this with someone you don't know. That'll maybe extra work. But go for it.
Now, I mean, I've been chuckling at things that you've both said, and there is an element of humour to it. You know, the whole idea of aphrodisiacs, it's a little bit, sort of feels a bit naughty, it feels a bit cheeky. I mean, the reality is, if somebody were to invent something that was a surefire aphrodisiac that affected the majority of people, at least, then they would be billionaires and most of the human race would stop doing anything useful and we would just be shagging our days away and it would be great, presumably. I mean, there is a serious point here. It's economics as well to all of this. And I think, you know, a bunch of the things that we, earlier on, you mentioned that everything at some point has been claimed to be an aphrodisiac. Are there people genuinely spending serious money searching for aphrodisiacs, Martha, in order to be able to market them? Or is this stuff best done on hopes and dreams?
Well, you know, you mentioned rhino horn, and I was reading recently that, in fact, it is not very often pursued as an aphrodisiac, more for medicinal qualities or for rare carvings. Again, going back to this very rare luxury type of thing. You know, no one's going after Spanish fly because it makes you feel like you have a really bad urinary tract infection, or maybe you do. But what I did read is like with some of the more rare things, the men have discovered that just Viagra is a much better solution and to speaking to more economical.
That was going to be my next question. Would you say that Viagra is an aphrodisiac?
Well, it's a tool. And if you can get into the mind frame, because that's required for it to work. I mean,
unless you want to have sex in the first place, you wouldn't take it.
Do what?
Unless you wanted to have sex in the first place, I guess you wouldn't take it. So you're already there, really.
Yeah. Or you're there for the potential. Like you take it hoping that things are going to pan out and then you're going to be able to perform. But I don't know how to just put into your brain, because our biggest aphrodisiac is our mind, of course. And so you've got to be there, or you've got to have someone that's going to take you there, walk you there through either food or touch or smell or taste or whatever it's going to be.
So, Martha, when people talk to you about your book, and it's been just spectacularly successful, they must ask for one tip or one element or one food or one particular bit of insight. If you could boil, I mean, you can't boil it down, obviously, but what's the one thing in passing that you would give somebody if you only had 1 minute to tell them?
Well, the first thing I'd say is just that it really is the act of connecting with somebody else. And we've got so many things competing for our time. And so when you say, hey, you're worth cooking for, you're worth eating this beautiful meal with, or this sexy 9.5 weeks kind of crazy meal with, it says, I care about you, you're worth my time. And then if you're looking for a single food, it's such a cliche, but chocolate. Does have things that are good for you. It kind of thins the blood, and phenylethylamine, can I say that ever again? It's which I'm screwing up, which attaches to, it creates dopamine release, but you literally would have to eat so much chocolate, it would be crazy. Mm. But what it does is that it melts on the tongue. It is a fat that really at body temperature just shines.
Yeah.
If you're not just munching on it, but you let it sort of sit in your mouth and melt, and it's just delicious. It has this creamy mouthfeel, and you're just looking for foods that work with your senses, the way it smells, the way it tastes, the way it looks. Everything.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, absolutely. So Ursula, if we look at back at the history of this, is the hunt for aphrodisiacs the preserve of the wealthy, or was everyone after them? I get what you say. You know, I get what you say that there are different levels of this for different people and different elements. You know, there's the exotic, then there's the sensual. These things aren't necessarily the preserve of the wealthy or the poor, but presumably the historical record leaves us with mainly the experiences of the wealthy.
Not only. I mean, this is true for many historical. Recipes in general, but in this case, not really, because what we have, especially in medical treaties of the antiquity, or also like what was called then natural science, I mean, Pliny the Elder and so on, what we have there is our recipes or tips, basically, that everybody could afford. It's a lot about onions and garlic and getting some fresh fish, but it was generally stuff that people couldn't afford. It's not so much on the luxurious side. So people took it kind of, I mean, for their time, like scientifically, as best as they could. So no, I wouldn't say so. Of course, the more money people had, they would go to exotic extremes and try to basically also to impress the other sex. I think that is an important part in this. But from the, antique medical point of view, no, that was for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And Martha, is there a darker side to aphrodisiacs? I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier on that, you know, the potential of a sort of, are you trying to convince somebody to do something they don't want to do? You know, and as a corollary to that, is it mainly men that are looking for something that will get women to go to bed with them, or is it equal on both sides?
You know, I just really feel like it's kind of a joint effort. All of us, if we're going to go to the trouble of figuring out how to incorporate aphrodisiacs into our life, it's a very concerted effort to either make somebody just want you on some level. So I don't think there's anything nefarious going on unless you're just drinking them to death, plying them with too much alcohol. And I'm not even sure that it's necessarily men more than women, but we definitely give more points to the man when he cooks a meal, right? I don't know what all's wrong with that, but if he does the dishes too, I mean, it's
what's not to love.
Deal is done.
I mean, that's why I learned to cook. It meant that I snogged more girls at university if I could cook. I mean,
right.
It really was as simple as that.
What was your signature dish? I know there was one.
I do you know what?
Yes, right.
Okay, I was very poor. I lived in college, and there were no cooking facilities. I had a sandwich toaster, and the cheapest protein I could buy was mackerel. So I would cook mackerel on my sandwich toaster, and literally the entire quad of my college hated me because the place stank. Nevertheless, it did the trick.
It's fish, it's high protein, it's
kind
of, not exotic, but let's say the idea is rare.
yeah, high protein. We're ticking off quite a few of the list here. The shape, I don't have a penis shaped like a mackerel, I have to say.
Good.
I have to draw the line.
So my niece is in college, and the other day she's a freshman, and she keeps talking about the boys, on and on with the boys. And the other day she's like, oh yeah, I was, you know, I don't know what I'm allowed to say on here. And
anything
he
you want,
me
this is aimed at adults.
And he walked me back to my dorm. Isn't that the sweetest thing? And I was like, you have the lowest bar possible. Imagine if he
takes
her a mackerel in his toaster oven. You know, like, that's it.
Oh, how things have changed. Well, I guess that is the question. How have things changed? I mean, what are the sources for... Because there, as we've mentioned a lot about the fact that there lots of things have been mentioned as aphrodisiacs in the past. So, Martha, when you were writing your book, did you discover that there is a long history in literature of discussion of aphrodisiacs?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church with my preacher father, which might explain some of what's going on. But anyway, the Bible is just chock-a-block full of just things. I don't know what King Solomon was thinking he was going to get away with, but he did, and he wrote about it, and he asked for more. And then, like, the Kama Sutra, it's filled, again, with all sorts of spices and herbs, the perfume garden. You know, this is all going back to, like, 4 BC and then 400, and I don't know when the Bible was all going on, but let me tell you, they were figuring it out. So there is that history of that, excuse me, and, you know, today I just think we don't even really need a book for it. You just know what you're trying to get and you go after it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ursula, I mean, was there a particular time when people started studying the effect of foods on the body? And if so, was it a beginning of a sort of an understanding of nutritional science?
No, I think the desire to change your bodily functions with food, and especially in an aphrodisiac way, is supposedly as old as humanity itself. Of course, we do not have the evidence, because how can we? But I don't see a historical beginning at any point, no.
Yeah. It's just always there in the historical record that people wanted to find an aphrodisiac.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Because there have been stages, Martha, when you know, when pornography has been quite popular. You know, it was you know, 17th century. You know, it was a big deal. Is that relevant? Do pornography and aphrodisiacs have a connection, or are they two very separate things?
Well, I think they're pretty separate things. I think pornography, for the most part, is just what you shouldn't do. Like, I just, again, not to bring my niece and nephew back into it, but I'm like, okay, you can go watch it. And like, whatever that was, it probably didn't feel good. And we're aphrodisiacs are not that way. And they can get sloppy and nasty and all the stuff that you want it to be. Or it can be just a mug of hot chocolate, you know, that my husband has made for me and I'm sitting on the couch. And so it's like, there's all these stages of relationships. There's the first date. I had a couple that they did an oyster recipe on their first date, and then they ended up getting married, and I was the maid of honor, and blah, blah, blah.
Very good.
So it just, but then you have, so there's that, and that doesn't necessarily go well, but then you get a few weeks into it, a few months into it, the people that were testing those recipes, it was just like totally out of the box. Then you have the people that have been together for 10 years with like 2 kids, and they're just like, oh my God, we're together without children. And then you have later where people are really, they've got the time, they've got the space. They just really are like, I want to show up for this relationship, and this is how I'm going to do it today. So there's all kinds of things, and none of that's related to pornography.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Ursula, Martha mentioned the idea that, you know, going out on Valentine's Day or Valentine's evening for dinner is actually a little bit of a you know, a food mill. You know, you're 7 p.m. sitting, 9 p.m. sitting, get out. Now, this is the food industry, and we are a food industry podcast here. So other than restaurants, when did the concept of making money from this, other than writing books and selling books, which I guess people didn't make that much money from to begin with, when did sort of products and industry and economics really begin to kick in for the aphrodisiacs?
That's a good question. I think, well, it's on an industrial scale pretty late, but you would always have had, you know, the neighborhood wise woman, or the, you know, somebody, some medical doctor or whoever was in charge of these things in your local neighborhood, that would have sold stuff, not on an industrial level, but I mean, the use of aphrodisiacs, love potions, as well as all kind of other miraculous, well, snake oils of all kinds of stuff, also is extremely old, and it's really hard to tell when it would have started. If we go back to written sources, I think since there was serious writing, we have also reports of people selling these kind of things. Not necessarily only aphrodisiacs, but all kinds of potions. That, again, is very, very old.
Yeah. And Martha, you mentioned, you know, things looking at mussels and looking at oysters and things that have a reference to, or they're an analog of female anatomy. But I would say that it's generally male anatomy that crops up. And certainly the foods that I've been offered, you know, mainly in places like Cameroon and China and places like that, are, you know, it's yak's penis and deer penis and dog penis and things like that. It's very male. You know, it's the male genitalia. And I spoke to the woman that ran the Peking penis restaurant, and I said, what about vaginas? You know, why there's no vagina on the menu? And she said, she could not stop laughing at it. And that was the most hilarious thing she'd ever heard. And I was thinking, hang on, what about the girls here? And she said, look, okay, the point is, I make my money from selling very expensive food to Chinese businessmen, and they tend to be male. You know, there were no women in the restaurant that night. That's apart from my producer, who was just eyes on stalks. And the owner said, look, I once heard of a restaurant selling donkey vulva, and again, she just basically, in English we say pissed herself laughing, and she just thought the whole idea was ridiculous. Why male genitalia rather than female genitalia, especially when I would have thought that all of these guys in the restaurant want to impress the woman? I mean, isn't there an opposites attract kind of, or am I getting this confused?
You know, I think guys just, well, this is a blanket statement, but in general just are under the misconception that we like actually care about a big donkey penis. Modifying my words here, like, we don't care, you know. Too big hurt. Okay, so, and if they actually think it's a sign of their virility, that's obviously ridiculous, and the only person in the world who would think that is a man. Okay. How many people have I offended in this half of the world? But in terms, no man or woman even needs to be convinced of like just the beauty. I mean, women, their shapes and they're soft and they're curves and they're this and they're that. I mean, we don't need to sell that. It's already been sold. And so that's my thinking. It's just ridiculous.
If I may, something,
I want to go to the
may
point,
say something
though,
about that as well, is 2 points. First of all, I think it's a little bit mixing up maybe in some very patriarchal societies between a natural, well, erection aid and an aphrodisiac, because that's a different thing. There we have the analogy again, that this body part will do the same to me. But that's not really an aphrodisiac, especially if they go out in all male groups. And, well, in case they want to afterwards have sex with a woman. You know, but and the second point is that historically, I don't see that at all. We have all these, mussels, shellfish, you were already saying that, all different kinds of mussels, of oysters. I mean, there were actually at the Baroque court in Versailles, they were holding banquets, erotic banquets, in which the man would have oysters and the women would suck on asparagus. And
you don't get a lot of nutrition from sucking on asparagus, do you?
Yeah, I hope they ate it also.
Saying.
If you put lots of butter, maybe, I don't know.
Fair enough.
Anyways, also, I mean, the whole egg story. Egg is, of course, a sign of female fertility. And another food that was considered an aphrodisiac, even the symbol of Aphrodite herself, is the pomegranate. And the pomegranate, it's all about the inner, it comes from the inside. It's red. It has a strong color. It's very juicy. It's a very strong fertility symbol also. Mm. So historically, I don't see that as much as you were saying now.
Okay. I've never seen a vagina that looks like a pomegranate, but maybe that's
I mean, you're more thinking uterus here.
I know what you think. Okay. Now, Martha, when you were writing your book, and I know that most authors, when they're writing a book, there is one fact that they just really want to tell everybody. That proves that this is why I wrote this book. And it's either a twist or a quirk. It's not necessarily the fundamental fulcrum of the book, but it's just the thing that makes you go, oh gosh, yes. Is there one of those in your book?
Well, you know, my co-author and I were 25, so we were thinking, what are we going to write about? We thought about all sorts of things, and we settled on this because it was food and sex, and it seemed just fundamental to our lives at the time. And one of the concepts is that we thought of all the images, and it's all of food set on the backdrop of the human body. And it's all just amateurs off the streets of Memphis, Tennessee. And I mean, we have an asparagus skirt. We have all sorts of things to reimagine how you think about food. And that was just really what we wanted to do. It was a creative outlet. It was super fun. We could get friends involved. It was just fun, which is really, I think, the essence of aphrodisiacs for me.
Okay, the fun is the element that people need. Okay, well, back to the idea of this being a food industry podcast, and I'd just like you to put you in a kind of materialistic headset for a second. And I know you're both very much in connected to the culture and the emotions of this thing. But how about hard cash for a second here? Ursula, do you think that there is an area that the food industry has not explored well enough in terms of connecting food with love?
Well, exactly the part that you've been saying. I mean, you can also cash in emotions and all of this. I think the industry is thinking too technically here. Again, thinking of, mainly male potency, I think. And there is the much more, the idea of, you know, candlelight dinners, of the whole sensual part of smell, of taste, of, that from that point of view, yes, there could be more done. Aphrodisiacs, as we, I think, have said many times now here, they are not only about a biological process.
Yeah.
On the contrary.
About context and everything else. Yeah. Martha, and anything else that you can think the food industry could capitalize on?
Yeah, just from a marketing perspective, I feel like there's a lot of room to do something, not just at Valentine's, but having it available throughout the year for, you know, bridal showers or for anniversaries or something like that. So like if I were a chocolatier, I might go and look at some of the herbs and spices that have historically been considered aphrodisiacs. And as we've mentioned, all of them have, so this should be easy. And you pick it, and you could have like a series of 12 or something with that tells a little story of each one, beautifully packaged, and of course a premium price, because why not? People will pay for that. It's a special time. Anytime you're giving someone that, it's something special. Or you could have a kit where you have like a food grade essential oil, and you can have you can mix little tinctures to do this massage oil with that, with a little brush and honey, which is too sticky, so you got to be careful where you use it, in anti-lubricant, one might say. But and then you can have like you can use then some of those ingredients to make a little dish, and there's a little recipe with it. And again, it's like very inexpensive to manufacture. You might need to spend some time if you're just doing it yourself, but you can put a premium price tag on that. I mean, even just having a dish on your menu that's especially, you know, you got the gluten-free and, you know, not another cauliflower pizza, but imagine if you're having this, oyster or whatever. So this is the world of marketing. You can twist this however you want, and there's plenty of space for gifts. Yeah. And I do think people get really stressed out about the idea of cooking a whole meal. And that's why I'm like, supplement with something from your favorite restaurants. You don't have to make the dessert. That could be the most time intensive part, or just supplement with whatever makes sense for you. Yeah. So
whatever floats your boat, I suppose, isn't it? Ursula.
That's very true. And I mean, as an example, We have a little farm here, and we do our own wine and so on. And I'm preparing from a batch of our wine each year a wine that is infused with clary sage. And wine infused with clary sage was considered by ancient Romans as an aphrodisiac. And apart from that, it tastes really good. And that wine is the hit on every party. Everybody always asks me to bring that. And I mean, we just have a very small production here. But if you could industrialize that, for example, I think it would go really well.
Okay, anyone with £50 million to spare, throw it Ursula Janssen's way. Now, I mean, is this about suggestion, Ursula? You know, if you put this, I mean, you can't say this is an aphrodisiac because I would imagine the health claims regulations don't allow things like that. But if you said this is an ancient, renowned as an aphrodisiac on the bottle, is that enough? Is the power of suggestion as important as the physiological power of the food to do something to your body?
I mean, usually it's a combination of all of them. And this you see with many of the classical aphrodisiacs. Like if you take wine, for example, it also has the alcohol. If you go for, let's say, a classic like caviar, oysters and champagne, you have the allergy of form in the oysters. You have, with the caviar, you have lots of proteins and with the oysters as well. You have the luxury. You have the eggs. And you have the alcohol. And if you stretch it a little further, you could also take the shape of the champagne flute into consideration, you know. I think several of these aspects have to come together and then it works.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so last question then. Martha, what's the dish for you? What's your aphrodisiac go-to dish?
I don't know if I have a go-to, like who can pick their favorite color or favorite song, but tonight I would love some orange blossom panna cotta. Super easy. I don't have any lactose issues. And you just take this beautiful orange blossom. It's just so fragrant. You put a little bit of that into cream, a little bit of gelatin. You let it set up. You can, again, don't have too much. I would put it into maybe a coupe or something. And it's just so beautiful and jiggly and cold. And I just love it.
Oh, you see, this is very difficult, really, because you're going to have to marry me if you carry on talking. And this is difficult because I'm already married. Ursula, what's your go-to aphrodisiac dish?
Ooh, that's hard to say also because there are different approaches. I both like the more medieval approach. We also have a lot of Middle Eastern recipes that use a lot of spices. So it's very heavily spiced. It has often also nuts that are strengthening, and which is simply very nice, beautiful, very, very nice sweets, spicy sweets. I have a YouTube video blog also. I once made a video about a spicy carrot paste from Andalusia, medieval Andalusia. That was not bad. But I think personally, I think I would go for the seafood, high protein champagne side of it. Yeah, simply because I love seafood.
That'll do. Okay, well, for my part, seeing as, just to be fair about this, I'd better throw mine is shellfish, wine and begging uncontrollably. That really does the trick for me. Okay, well, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you both so much for your time and your insight. I'm blown away by both the history and the sort of the sense of context that you've thrown at this, which makes it all so much more understandable. Ursula Janssen and Martha Hopkins, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.